Welcome to the Nth Venture.
This week, I get to sit down with Geoff Roberts of Outsetta, a fascinating tech platform that integrates a lot of the functions that you're trying to achieve with the CRMs, the Salesforces, and such of the world, and integrating into a delivery platform. So I found it fascinating the way that they had bootstrapped this and kind of the lessons learned there. And they do equity in a very interesting way and very, I think, philosophically aligned with what we do here then. So no further ado, please welcome Geoff. All right. Here he is, Mr. Geoff Roberts. Welcome, co-founder of Outsetta. It's a pleasure to have you here, buddy. I'm excited to dig in with you today. I think what you guys have built is the right way. And I imagine that some of the influence of HubSpot rubbed off on you in terms of how you guys are going about building this thing. And what I've seen, at least from the outside, the way that you guys manage the team through open books and everything that I've seen, not only with the team, but through the whole world, I'm very much impressed by. And I don't know, I'm excited to dig in with you. I think you got the right approach, and the product seems to be doing very well.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and excited to tell you a little bit more about the product and the company.
Well, one of the things I'm always intrigued by is, you know, not only just what you're doing today and what you're doing now, but kind of how you got here. I think for the folks, it's always fascinating to learn about the trials and tribulations before you even really got going. And so I know you have some interesting tales kind of before Outsetta even came together. From what I can tell, some of the interesting folks you got to work with getting in for a company that then got acquired by a big monster, I'm sure is an interesting story. If you look back, is there anywhere that kind of jumps out at you as like, this really, you know, what was a moment that kind of started my path towards what ultimately became kind of Outsetta?
Yeah, absolutely. So I sort of found my way into the tech industry and startups in general, absolutely on accident. I went to college and was a writing major. So I thought I was going to like work for a newspaper or write for Sports Illustrated or something like that. Basically got out of college while the economy was tanking in 2008. Didn't really know what to do. Saw newspapers and whatnot folding. So I went back to school and got an MBA, honestly, because I just didn't know what else to do. And the combination of the business experience and the writing background sort of led me into marketing. The economy was still awful when I finished my MBA. And I started applying for jobs. The job that I got was at a tech startup in Boston called Buildium, where I was one of the first 10 or so employees. And that's where this whole journey ultimately started for me. If I'm honest, I wasn't super enthusiastic about taking the job. I didn't really have any sort of affection for software in general. Buildium was in the property management industry, which isn't exactly the sexiest industry, but I just kind of fell into a great situation without even realizing it, to be honest with you. I had found a company that had found product market fit. They were almost all engineers. They had no one that was really dedicated to growth, and they took a shot on me and gave me a shot to take the software product they'd built and see how far I could run with it, essentially. And in the process, I just fell in love with startups in general. I tell people today, and I don't say this to be uninspiring, but like I'm not a techie person per se. I don't really have any particular tie to the software industry, although it's where I've built my career at this point. I love startups and I like sort of taking something and helping it grow into its potential. Software happens to be the industry where I do that now. But aside from just sort of landing in this tech startup and building my career there, one of the things that I witnessed at Buildium was all of the inefficiencies that come with building a SaaS startup in the earliest days and all the different tools and technologies you need to integrate together to even run one of those businesses. So that ultimately sort of gave me a front row seat to all those challenges, which, long story short, resulted in Outsetta. Outsetta is sort of the tech stack that I wish existed in the early days at Buildium. So I took a lot of learnings from that job and then founded a company to solve the problems that I saw.
Well, I think I had the right approach from what I can tell. And then at Buildium, you know, kind of the first big experience working in that world. And then, you know, you're over to what ultimately got acquired by SAP as a VP of marketing. So what was that experience like, kind of the second go around, going from somewhere that's, you know, pretty heavily kind of engineering focus to got Sequoia backing and, you know, all those kinds of fancy things going on.
Yeah, very, very different experiences. So in short, I would summarize it as I spent 5 years at Buildium and saw a SaaS company do everything right. long story short, the product was awesome. The team was awesome. How the company was built was awesome. And we had this, you know, big successful exit. So in terms of just learning, Buildium was second to none. I sort of, to this day, have enormous benefits from starting my career in a place that was so successful. After that, I went to another company called Rombi that was also acquired by SAP. But that was a different circumstance. When I arrived at Rombi, the company was kind of in need of a turnaround. It had sort of fallen on hard times. They were Sequoia backed. They had been heavily venture funded. They had built this amazing piece of technology, but they hadn't really figured out how to make sort of the unit economics within the business work, at least long term. So while I was in this company that had all these, you know, really high profile investors and a lot of eyeballs on it, it was a much more challenging experience, to be honest with you. We needed to, you know, at Buildium, we were kind of trying to hold on. We were rolling downhill, so to speak, and we're just trying to hold on and put a lasso around the growth that we were feeling. At Rombi, it was really scratching and clawing to figure out how do we take this amazing technology that we've built and sort of deliver on the sales and marketing side, the type of outcome that we want to. Ultimately, SAP did come along and I got to sort of see, you know, that type of acquisition firsthand, where I think at that time, it might've even been the biggest software company in the world was acquiring, you know, your little startup. So certainly an interesting experience, but very, very different in terms of kind of the trajectory that the companies were on. And that was an interesting learning in and of itself.
Yeah, I think that dichotomy is like beautiful there. So what would you say in terms of like some of the key differences there that may have kind of created that different dynamic? Obviously sounds like the great team and something that matched a lot of product market fit, I guess is how they would typically say it, probably, as opposed to something that was maybe more heavily venture funded, it sounds like, and, you know, it created something that they were really excited about, but maybe, you know, was having difficulty getting demand for. I feel like there's a lot of lessons in
there. Oh, there's so many. They are sort of polar opposite businesses in terms of like the sex appeal of the business. So Buildium is property management software. It basically collects rent payments. So if you have, you know, 10 rental properties and 30 tenants, it's difficult to track who's paid you rent and who hasn't. That's what Buildium does, greatly distilled. But it was sort of a boring problem, a boring industry, an industry that hadn't even been touched by tech whatsoever. So we kind of went in and said, you know, you're collecting rent checks manually. We're just going to help you do that online. And even when Buildium became big and successful, there were no eyeballs on the company outside of investors that wanted to put money into it. But nobody cares about the property management industry. You don't see people, you know, on tech Twitter talking about companies in these sort of unsexy industries like you do with marketing technology. Rombi was the exact opposite. So the guy that started Rombi was a serial entrepreneur and very skilled at sort of looking at upcoming tech trends and thinking about how to exploit them and build products around them and that sort of thing. He basically went out and bought an iPhone, played with the interface of the iPhone and said, you know, this little device has the ability to visualize data for users that are out in the field, whatever the field is, whatever sort of work they do out of the office, they can visualize large data sets on an iPhone in a way that you never could on a BlackBerry or, you know, older cell phones. So he started building this really still unique and super impressive tool to visualize data sets on a mobile phone. And it was sort of taking advantage of this cutting edge technology and recognizing sort of the business potential of an iPhone. But they almost built this amazing technology and this amazing visualization tool without a concrete use case in the same way that Buildium had this very concrete use case. So it's kind of a fascinating lesson in solving a boring problem versus focusing on being early and taking advantage of an emerging technology. And I think ultimately with Rombi, they did find some use cases. I mean, the company grew to $10+ million in revenue, but I don't think they ever sort of found the most sustainable use case to build the business over the long term, whereas a Buildium did. So I think that's kind of the key learning. There's so much emphasis on, can you be early to a market? Can you have a first mover advantage? And people like these shiny new things, right? We're seeing that with AI right now in particular. But it's not just, can you take advantage of this shiny new thing? It's, can you find real use cases for this that solve real world problems? And I think that's what we're seeing right now with AI. It's like, let's just slap AI on everything and it's going to solve all of our problems. And it's like, well, no, we're just over-indexing on the excitement around the potential of AI right now. We need to find those concrete real-world use cases.
Yeah, the hype squad. I found that the businesses that we have, almost to a T, the more boring, the better. All right, so you have these very interesting experiences. And then I think it's straight to Outset after that. Am I missing one?
Yeah, pretty much. I've done some consulting and worked some other stuff too, but
I think there's always a little bit of narrative fallacy of like, oh, this is how I came up with the idea type of thing. But like, you know, tell me a little bit about how all that kind of came together. Obviously, you've got, you know, co-founders who are with you. What did that look like as you guys started figuring out, hey, what can we do here? It's a market we can serve.
So when I was at Buildium, long story short, I was sort of the business user within the company. And my now co-founder at Outsetta, his name is Dimitri. He was one of the co-founders of Buildium, and he was the CTO, and I was kind of pulling on his shirt sleeves saying, hey, we need to buy something like Salesforce now to be a real CRM. We need HubSpot for marketing automation. We need Zendesk for support. We need to integrate Stripe for billing. And he's kind of a stubborn guy. And at one point he just threw his hands up and he was like, we're an early stage SaaS business. First of all, we need to buy and pay for all these tools. Secondarily, as the technical co-founder of this company, I'm spending an enormous amount of my time evaluating and integrating these tools that our business relies on rather than doing what I should be doing, which is actually building our software. So that's sort of where we recognized this problem. And long story short, Dimitri ended up being an engineer and kind of a stubborn guy, building a really basic homegrown tech stack, like a really simple billing system, a really simple support ticketing system, a really simple CRM. And we used that tech stack until the business was almost at $6 or $7 million in revenue. And it served us really, really well. And when we were both ready to move on from Buildium, we kind of looked back and said, you know what? Every SaaS founder is doing the exact same thing. They all need essentially the same tooling. And no one's brought those tools together in a single platform to sort of help a founder launch faster and let them get back to building sort of their core product rather than integrating all these systems. So that's where the product idea came from. We basically said this worked really well for us. Let's build it in a way where we can commercialize it. And that's the origin story of the company in a nutshell.
I can attest to the nightmare. And especially, you know, we see it at Infinity because we're setting up all of these businesses. So not only doing it for ourselves, but for each and every one of them. And it is an absolute nightmare. And CRMs have to be kind of different depending on the business. And the way that they do billing is all, it all has to be kind of like teed in. But they all have very similar problems. And then the customization just gets nuts. Setting up Salesforce is a nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
Absolutely.
And then you got to train people. I mean, it's horrific. So I can relate on a more intimate level than most in terms of getting all of this set up. What did that look like in the early days as you guys were setting it up? I know you have a very interesting philosophy around comp that I'm sure I could appreciate. You guys came together and decided to kind of bootstrap it more or less, right? Built something I think that's really interesting. Tell me about maybe some of those early days and how you decided to like, hey, how are we going to tackle, you know, building this startup?
Yeah. So I think there are a few things of note, just in terms of like choosing this idea and having conviction that this was the right idea, or at least an idea worth sinking our teeth into. We had lived the problems firsthand, right? So I think we ultimately said, if we can deliver, you know, this set of tools in an integrated tech stack, it's a better solution. We had a high degree of confidence in that. Beyond that, we sort of looked and said, if we're going to bootstrap this company, this is a huge development effort. It's building a billing system, a CRM, an email tool, a help desk. This is a 15 or 20 year project. But we were comfortable saying, okay, we're going to bite this off because we made a bet that it was a durable idea. People are going to need billing systems and CRMs and email tools long into the future. So we felt okay saying we're going to make a long-term bet on this. If we bootstrap it, we know we're working with a long time horizon, but we don't think this idea is just going to evaporate. So it was attractive from those perspectives. beyond that, just kind of assembling the team, I would say we assembled our co-founding team because we have very complementary skill sets. I'm ultimately a marketer. I think of myself as a marketer. That's my background. And the other two co-founders are a back-end developer and a front-end developer. So we looked at the three of us and said, we basically have the skill set here to bring this, build this product and also bring it to market. So that was part of the decision. And then I think most importantly, and you sort of alluded to some of this, we chose to work together largely because we have a ton of philosophical alignment, or had and still do, around how we wanted to build the business. With Buildium in particular, we went down very much the standard venture-backed path that most tech startups do. We bootstrapped the company for a long time, but we ended up raising several rounds of funding and sort of going all in and pursuing growth at all costs and all of that, and had a very successful run and like no negative experience. So what we're doing now is not a reaction to any sort of bad experience, but we sort of looked back at it and said, we had way more fun as a company of 20 than we did as a company of 200. So if we're going to do this again, like, let's do things on our terms. And there are a few things that are sort of paramount to our terms. One was, we do want to keep the company independent and small by design. So we haven't like formalized this in any way, but something we talk about a lot is actually not wanting to grow beyond 20 employees and basically seeing how far we can push the company with 20 employees and what levels of revenue we can get to with 20 employees. And the second part of that is, as we built out a bigger organization, we saw that sort of two organizations were oftentimes part of the same organization. There was sort of this second class organization of younger people, customer support people in particular. And we noticed that we were adding a lot of headcount to these more junior, particularly customer service and sales oriented roles, and said, we think we can operate a business essentially without those roles. Not that they're not necessary functions, but if you're writing into support, wouldn't it be better to get an engineer with 20 years of experience who can actually solve your issue rather than just somebody who's escalating your issue to that engineer? So in addition to just sort of keeping the team small, we hire pretty senior, pretty experienced people. We're trying to build a team of, you know, 20A players, so to speak. That's a big part of why we work together. And as part of that, there's no hierarchy within Outsetta whatsoever. Everybody is essentially treated the same. So we do have a standardized salary that everybody earns. And similarly, everybody earns equity in the business at the exact same rate in terms as the founders. So it is a model that is unique. It's certainly not for everybody, but the overarching idea is bring the highest quality people onto the team that we possibly can, let them figure out where they can contribute to the business, and incentivize them in a way where they want to act as owners because they are actually owners. And that's what we've been up to for 6 years now.
That sounds almost like you're describing its venture. So it's kind of surreal to hear it from somebody else. I very much relate to what you guys have put together. The idea around 20 employees, I think, is really interesting. I think right around that number, like the 20 or 30, like, you know, getting to a platoon size element is right when it starts changing a little bit. We've got folks that are at and they're kind of like in the portfolio companies, but we're kind of getting to that size where it changes a lot. You know, you don't have as close relationships with all of them. The other day we like hired somebody I'd never met, never seen their name. I was like, oh my gosh, this is wild.
Sure.
it starts getting interesting, and it's a totally different world. And I think you're probably right to stick around that size kind of intentionally. What is, you guys were getting started, were some of the biggest hurdles and challenges in the first few years? You're 5 years in, right?
We just turned six. So,
you know, as you guys are getting started, I'm sure those are different problems than you've got now. But what kind of strikes you as the highlights of some of the biggest issues you guys have had?
Yeah, there's two that come to mind with, you know, the benefit of retrospect, so to speak. Part of the reason we chose the idea for Outsetta that we did was it was this huge software product. My two co-founders were very forward in saying, we like this problem because it is a big and meaty problem, and we think it has the potential of holding our attention for the next 15 years. I don't want to say that was wrong. I think it was well-intentioned. But boy, oh boy, did we get what we bargained for. I think in retrospect, you know, we bootstrapped this massive product that if I had to look back, I probably would not bootstrap this idea. I think it is very clearly a venture-backed idea that we just happened to devote the last 5 years to bootstrapping. So that's certainly something of a lesson learned. It's just like how you're funded has to match what you're building. And I think like we just had years of pain because it took us 2 years to even deliver an MVP. We sort of struggled in year three to figure out how to sell this thing. After 3 years, we had almost nothing to show for 3 years of effort. And then in years four, five, and six, we really started growing in earnest. So I think that's definitely a lesson. That was one of our initial challenges, albeit something of a self-inflicted wound. The other thing I would say is when we started out, we were point blank focused on selling to technical founders of SaaS businesses. And they tell you, you know, in startup land that particularly early on, you need to niche down and focus on, you know, one particular audience, one particular problem. I think ultimately we did that to a fault, and that frankly is largely on me. When we launched the product and we started initially marketing and selling the product, I really honed in on developers and founders of SaaS businesses. And what I found pretty quickly was we were trying to change their predominant behavior. I would talk to developers and say, listen, we've got this product that's going to speed to market for you. It's going to give you this perfectly integrated tech stack more quickly so you can focus on building your core product. And they all nodded their heads and said, you know, yes, that's great. But at the end of the day, these are technical people that have the skill set to build the perfect tech stack. And even when they acknowledged it might not be the best use of their time, a lot of developers just have a passion for their craft and sort of want to do that regardless of it not being the best use of their time. So we were really fighting an uphill battle targeting that audience early on. And I think beyond that, developers are tough customers to sell to, right? They live in the technology world. They know the alternatives that are out there. And I was going to them saying, try our email tool. And they'd come back and say, it's not that great of an email tool. There's, you know, 20, 30 other products out there that are just as good, if not better. So I think it was a hard pill to swallow that, first of all, we were trying to change their behavior. Secondarily, they were a very demanding buyer. And it took us years to just get the product to the place where it was good enough to truly be competitive with the other products that were out there. So one of the things that really started our growth in earnest was actually moving beyond just focusing on developers. We sort of got discovered by the no-code community and very quickly realized the sort of all-in-one nature of the product was even more valuable to a less technical builder who doesn't have the skill set to assemble all these systems. And that's really when our growth started out in earnest. Since then, developers have kind of come storming back, and we very much have a customer base that's split between both technical and non-technical. But I think those were two of the things that really led to our early struggles, just the size of what we were building and trying to change sort of the predominant behavior of our target market.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like selling somebody something that's going to like end their job, you know, type of deal. I could see that. I could see that being challenging.
It's really funny that you say that. Something that we see even today is there will be a lot of people that a lot of SaaS companies will come to us where it's a non-technical founder. And they have hired like overseas developers to build out their product and their tech stack. And the non-technical founder would be like, you should use Outsetta. This looks like a great tool. It's going to be helpful to me in managing the business. It's going to help us launch this business faster. And the overseas developer is like, wait a minute, I don't want to use this because this is going to, you know, cut down on the work that you just hired me to do by a dramatic percentage. And they also like, they're like talking the non-technical founder into assembling the tech stack by some other means because they want to be paid for their time doing that work. So it's kind of an interesting problem to have. But
it's almost like you want to get in before they even have like a CTO.
100%.
It's like, yep. Hey, build out your product. So tell me, you know, kind of in some degree of depth, what you guys are delivering for them. Obviously, it seems to me that you're kind of putting together the key aspects of a CRM and like a marketing tool and billing kind of all into one. Am I saying that right? How would you describe it?
Yeah, there's sort of four or five categories of software that we cover, but the two that people initially buy outset of four are authentication and payments. So you need some way for users to come to your site, pick a plan, pay you, and then log into your product. That's kind of the core of Outsetta, and that's like the first thing that you set up and ultimately what the buying decision is usually made around. Beyond that, once you've got authentication and payments integrated with your product, you're sort of running your business on Outsetta, and then you grow into the other tools that we offer. So there's a CRM, there's an email marketing system, there's a help desk, and then reporting tools. So our sort of view of the world is if you look at any subscription business, whether it's a SaaS business or a membership business, they all need payments, they all need authentication, they all need, you know, a CRM to track their prospects and customers, they need email as a communication tool, and they need a help desk to sort of support the customer base. Those are like tools that in 95% of these businesses you see. So that's kind of the core set of tools that we deliver.
Yeah. And then so in terms of like the login, you know, how deep do you guys get into the whole account system and, you know, portaling for accounts and things like that for these folks?
Yeah. So that's really like what Outsetta does best. If someone comes to your website and signs up and then logs in, like at login, we recognize who the user is. So you can show them the appropriate version of their product based on the subscription that they purchased. We create a user account. We automatically create like a CRM record. Just that initial sign up can start, you know, triggering onboarding emails and things like that. So that whole process around both registration and account creation is really sort of our bread and butter.
What have you guys seen because like surprising use cases out there?
So we definitely, as I said, started out focusing on SaaS, and like our own business is a traditional SaaS business and runs completely on SaaS. The second use case that I was just too slow to see, to be honest with you, was membership sites and sort of no code builders. Lots of times building on Webflow, that's certainly the most common one, but lots of users building sites on Notion and things like that, where they're just charging for access to content of some sort, whether it's written content or video content. The third one that's emerged is online communities. So if you've got a Discord server or a Circle community or a Slack community, you can use Outsetta to monetize it and sort of manage your members within your community. And then the fourth one, which we've put zero effort into, but we continue to see it kind of growing slowly, is people using Outsetta as almost a personal tech stack for a freelancing or consulting business. So if you are a marketing consultant and you sell your services on some sort of retainer basis, you can use Outsetta to charge your customers, and then you've got essentially a tech stack comparable to what you would see in a much more sophisticated, you know, venture-backed SaaS company that you can use for your own use. So those are sort of the four use cases that are common, at least.
For the pricing side, have you guys, I assume it's kind of like subject to whatever Stripe will allow to push through, but do you guys primarily find yourself operating in like the sub $5,000 type of payments, or are they, does, I guess, it matter, you know, what kind of sizing? Because, you know, membership sites versus something that's like selling product or big engagements or something like that, totally different, right?
Yeah, I would say our customer base definitely leans towards like lower ACV, higher volume type of products. If you're selling, you know, like enterprise-y software where it's a $50,000 contract, people typically just don't want to pay credit card processing fees on transactions of that size. So I would say in that case, you know, you're probably looking for a product with a feature set where you can like accept payments via ACH and send out proposals and that kind of stuff. Outsetta doesn't really serve that use case pretty or very well. Most of our customers, I would say, they're selling subscriptions that are $10,000 a month at sort of the high end or under.
As you guys have kind of built out this very interesting world here, what you've already built is interesting, but maybe give us a little of a sense of, you know, what is Outsetta kind of, you think, going to become over the next, you know, 5-6 years? You know, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So one of the things that is both a strength and a weakness of Outsetta is Outsetta itself does not help you deliver your product in any way. So our sort of ethos and our mindset is, whether you're building a SaaS product or a website or an online community, you should choose the tool that you want to use to deliver it, whatever it is that you're delivering. Outsider then kind of plugs in and becomes the engine for your business that processes the payments and logs you into the community or product and gives you all these tools to sort of manage the member base going forward. And I think that's both a positive and a negative. It's a positive in the sense that we're super flexible and you can use us in lots of different use cases. But it's a negative in the sense that we are certainly seeing it's easier to integrate payments and other tools with all the other technology products that are out there. And it's continuing to get easier and easier and easier. So as an example, part of the reason we built Outsider when we started out was Stripe did not offer what's now known as Stripe billing. They did not have good solutions for a SaaS founder building a SaaS business. They had nice APIs that you could work with, but there wasn't an easy way to sort of set up subscription billing on top of Stripe. So we built it. Since then, Stripe has built Stripe billing and they offer something quite comparable to Outsider on the billing front. So our point of differentiation has become that we are this all-in-one tech stack that, you know, brings in the CRM and the email and the help desk. And we've seen that consistently with other technologies too. So outside of Stripe, Webflow is our other sort of big partner. We really started growing in the no-code community because of Webflow. And at the time that that started, Webflow did not offer their own payments tools or their own authentication tools. Now they're starting to do that. So is there like some risk to our business because of that? All of these external platforms starting to offer comparable services. To some extent, yes. To another extent, no. The fact that we are this all-in-one tech stack is really unique, and that's why we continue to be used by both SaaS founders and people building on top of Webflow and whatnot. But when I look to our future, that's sort of the most interesting question. We know from a product roadmap perspective, like what we're focusing on, and in short, that's just taking our existing tool set and making all the tools that much better. But at some point, do we need to kind of pick a direction or a set of tools and technologies that we're just going to focus on? That's very much up in the air for me. I don't know what the answer to that question is, and if we will at some point say, you know, we're going all in on just being the perfect tech stack for SaaS founders. Are we going to go all in on being a tech stack that integrates really well with Webflow? Or are we going to just continue to do what we're doing and be broadly applicable to lots of different ways of delivering your website or content? That's kind of the big outstanding question at the moment.
I assume a lot of value for folks like me is like, okay, I can set and forget it. You know, it's just like this thing that just works on a broad set of things, but you guys have what I can tell to be kind of the horsepower to build any particular part of it into being like a premier flagship part of the product, right? So I imagine that's a constant challenge. And then, you know, segmenting the market to just becoming totally saturated with them is kind of the go-to. That's interesting. You've got an interesting road ahead for sure. So is there anything what I love asking folks as we kind of wrap up here is, you know, you've had this pretty interesting set of experiences, you know, Outsider, all the stuff that came before. For the folks that, you know, are just getting going or, you know, just getting exposed to this kind of thing, if you could go back and tell yourself something as you're just getting started, is there anything that comes to mind? So is there anything you know now that you wish you knew then?
Yeah, I think since we started, I have personally gotten a PhD in selecting startup ideas. And certainly through my own experience of all the different companies that I've worked at, I, you know, had started to learn some of these things anyways. But now working at Outsider on a day-to-day basis, all I do is talk to founders who are launching early stage startups, and they're asking me questions about their startup and how I would do X, Y, and Z and all those kinds of things. And just being exposed to that many founders, I've very much, I don't want to say formalized, but sort of crystallized my own thinking about what makes a good startup idea and what I would work on in the future. Without setup point blank, I think that the reason I signed on to build this company was largely the two co-founders. Their names are Dimitri and Dave. They are both about 10 years older than me, a little bit further along in their career than me, and exceptionally talented software engineers. And when we first started talking about building this, to some extent, my mindset was, I don't care what we build. I know that if I build it with these guys, they're going to build a world-class product. And that's a big part of the reason that I signed on to build it. As I mentioned, like one of my biggest learnings was there's sort of this disconnect between how we chose to build the business and what we were building. So I think going forward, I would be much more stringent on making sure that the funding model matches the product vision, and also other things like, if you are going to bootstrap, I think you can actually look ahead with some degree of foresight and say, is the type of product we're building, for example, a product that's always going to require a lot of customer support investment? If so, that has huge implications on the future of the company in terms of who you need to hire, how big the team needs to be, what your day-to-day work looks like. And I think there aren't like, and I'm just using support as an example, but I think there are ideas out there where you can look at them early on and say, this is a product where once it's purchased, there is very little need for ongoing support. And that is hugely attractive because it's going to allow us to scale the business with fewer employees and yada, yada, yada. So those sorts of decisions, I don't want to advocate for people becoming like paralyzed with looking for the perfect startup idea, because as everyone knows, these things kind of morph anyways, and you might not even end up building what you set out to build. But I can't emphasize enough really thinking through, does this idea, you know, match what I want my work to look like over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
That's a great set of advice there. Geoff Roberts, thank you so much for hopping on the adventure, buddy. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you too. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, you listen, it's going down just like this.
This has been an Audley production. Thank you for tuning in. Have a lovely, lovely day. We'll see you next time.